Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing possibility that a new intifada is brewing in Israel and Palestine, as stabbings of Israelis by Palestinians in Jerusalem have put the holy city on edge. Kate Gould, the Legislative Associate for Middle East Policy at the Quaker Lobby, the Friends Committee on National Legislation, joins us. She lobbies Capitol Hill and the White House on Israel-Palestine peace, and we'll discuss the difficult job she has as Palestinian frustration over a phony peace process that is stalled while Jewish settlements continue to expand on the West Bank appears to have reached a boiling point. Then we'll examine last night's first Democratic presidential debate, candidates debate, and speak with Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. The author of Who Governs? Presidents, Public Opinion, and Manipulation, he joins us to discuss his research from confidential documents in presidential archives that indicate both Republican and Democratic presidents, while claiming to speak for the people and serve the public good, actually serve and are guided by America's wealthy elites. We will discuss whether, if elected, Bernie Sanders would break that tradition. Then finally, we'll speak with Dr. Anna Greenberg, a leading Democratic pollster with Greenberg Quinlan Rosner, about the possibility, since Bernie Sanders rebuked the press for perpetuating the phony scandal by beating up on Hillary over her emails, that Bernie Sanders could end up being Hillary Clinton's vice presidential running mate. A seasoned campaign professional offers her opinion that Bernie Sanders will go the way of Howard Dean and be a footnote, since he lacks the campaign ground game and therefore without a national infrastructure would have no traction in the general election. And joining us now is Kate Gould, the Legislative Associate for Middle East Policy at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies on the Israel-Palestine peace and has a piece and joins us now. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kate Gould.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be back.
And your job is a pretty tough one now, because it does feel that a new intifada is brewing following these stabbings and the shootings of the assailants. I understand that the city of Jerusalem is extremely tense.
That's right. In the last 72 hours, I've heard from Israelis and Palestinians on the ground that are very afraid. There's real fears about a third intifada or about something much worse. So what we've seen this month, the casualty count, 7 Israelis, about 30 Palestinians have been killed just since, you know, October 1st, and there are estimates of over 1,000 injuries. And while we've seen those numbers don't compare with the far higher casualty counts of the first and second intifadas, the violence has hinted, the way that the violence has been perpetrated has hinted at a phenomenon that could end up being even deadlier. And, you know, that's because the first and second intifadas were politically organized. That's sort of the definition of what they were. They were politically organized uprisings. And in this case, we're seeing violence perpetrated by Palestinians and Israelis who some of them have you know, don't identify as political at all. And they've been killing people with screwdrivers, and, you know, with settlers killing Palestinians, you know, carrying guns and saying they're not making a political point, but they're killing people. So, I mean, that is so dangerous. And you know, while it's certainly, though, the case that the underlying cause of this violence is political and can only be solved through a political solution.
But it does seem that the fact that at the United Nations, President Abbas, the Palestinian Authority leader, that first of all, they raised the flag, which the U.S. Boycotted, but most of the world, at least a number of important countries like France and Russia and others, joined in that ceremony. And then Abbas also made in the speech said that he was basically giving up on the Oslo Accords. He hasn't gone the full step of saying that he will no longer cooperate with Israel over security. But it seems to be spiraling out of control, and Prime Minister Netanyahu has not offered any solutions except criticism of Abbas. So Have you heard anything on the from the Israelis that would indicate that they have a plan to stop this thing spiraling out of control?
Well, what is particularly grim news is that the Israeli plans at the highest leadership, that what they're talking about, of course, are responding to the violence with more collective punishment measures. And, of course, it's collective punishment that actually undergirds and causes so much of the violence that we're seeing today. So this idea of closing off East Jerusalem, of punishing all Palestinians in East Jerusalem for the crimes of a few, and, you know, and just a siege of the West Bank and further bombing of Gaza to respond to the crimes of a few, and that's only going to lead to more bloodshed on all sides, of course. So it is we're not seeing solutions from the political leadership. We are seeing, you know, on the U.S. side, it is. Of course, there's the news that Kerry will travel to the region, but it's yet to be seen what he'll do and whether the U.S. will actually use its leverage that can be used to save lives, to, as you said, to end this phony peace process and look for a real way forward that can end settlements, that uses the leverage that the U.S. has with military aid. And you know, while that we don't expect movement on that so soon, we there are some very concrete, relatively simple steps that Kerry could take in the interim. For example, of convening the Israeli-Palestinian and Jordanian leaders to address the situation at Al-Aqsa Mosque and at Temple Mount and Haram al-Sharif. So there are steps that can be used, and the U.S. has the leverage to do so, but yet to be seen whether there's the political will to do it.
And again, I'm speaking with Kate Gould, who is a Legislative Associate for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies for Israel-Palestine peace. So how much is the disturbances at the Al-Aqsa, the Temple Mount, contributed towards this? I mean, that's something that's quite simply shouldn't be made a provocative situation. It's a provocative enough situation as it is, but the history of it is such that you know that the minute you start interfering with the ability of Muslims to go to the third holiest shrine in Islam, you've got trouble on your hands.
That's right. And of course, for a long time, many Palestinians have been blocked from ever being able to visit Al-Aqsa Mosque, and now there are concerns that, and even the State Department said that it's unclear what the Israeli intentions are here, whether they will change what the status quo has been, and whether there's questions about whether Palestinians will be allowed to worship at this holy site. So it is very scary. It is a dangerous moment, and that the barring Palestinians from being able to worship has contributed, has been a huge factor in the current spate of violence.
But in terms of this phony peace process, where we've had a peace process but no peace, and I don't think anybody can maintain the fiction much longer, can they? I mean, there was, of course, a while back a leak to Al Jazeera of the Palestinian papers that indicated how ridiculous this process has been and how much the Palestinian Authority have been completely taken to the cleaners by the Israelis. The bottom line is that the Palestinians have got nothing. They get more and more squeezed while Israel gets more and more land and more power. So this is a case of the powerful getting more powerful and the powerless getting more powerless, isn't it?
Well, yes, we certainly are not expecting a grand solution and revival of authentic peace process in the near term. And, you know, I mean, I've very good points you raise. Unfortunately, sitting on Capitol Hill and thinking about the conversations I've had with members of Congress and staff about this, it's incredible what a different world it is here, and that many of the issues you raised have not penetrated the discourse, of course, in Washington. That I heard from a senior staffer to a Democratic senator today about how they have just been slammed with this campaign to get the senator to issue a statement, only condemning the killings of Israelis and not mentioning Palestinians, and the senator decided to do that, unfortunately, and not mention the violence on both sides and the incitement on all sides and the need for a solution that saves lives on all sides, So I think, it's here in Washington, the tone is very different, and the assumptions and conclusions are very different. But I think no one is expecting a full out peace process right now. What can be done, in even in Kerry's one trip, is a convening of a meeting to address the situation at the Temple Mount, Haram al-Sharif. He did this in 2014, and in 2014 we saw that meeting apparently leaders came to some private understandings, but that eroded over time. So this time we really need to see a public reassertion from all of the leaders that the status quo of the agreement of, at the site where Palestinian Muslims will continue to be able to worship is not under threat, and that it won't be threatened by these Jewish settlers who have said outright that their goal is to demolish the mosque. So that's a first step that can certainly de-escalate the violence. But of course it won't end until the occupation ends. We see a beginning of a solution.
But if the settlers were to demolish the Al-Aqsa Mosque, that would be an earthquake in the entire Islamic world. We know that because there was some crazy Australian that years ago was trying to blow it up, mm-hmm. and the Israelis captured him. And there are a lot of people in Israel, in the security service, in Shin Bet, and in Mossad, who know how crazy that is. I mean, so what's going on there with Netanyahu? And we know that the Israeli right does not have an end game vis-a-vis the Palestinians. They simply have not stated what their final solution, I hate to use that term, is for the Palestinian situation. So, and they've been sort of just, as I say, going along with this phony peace process, which is just a process, but it's not yielding any peace. So is there any way that at some point soon there's going to be some honesty about what's really going on here?
Well, I think we can. The best way to predict the future is to create it. I mean, in a positive way, and to stop it to start an honest conversation. And the U.S. role is going to be critical in that. As you mentioned, there are Israeli security establishment figures who have been speaking up about this. Even we saw Ephraim Halevi, former head of the Mossad, say that Israel needs to look at a different way of engaging with Hamas and looking at the possibility of real negotiations there or diplomatic engagement. And so we've seen certainly from the Israeli security establishment that they have risked their political careers in order to say some pretty courageous things. Unfortunately, I think that what sounds like from the broader political establishment in Israel is that they're gripped by fear, and there's unfortunately we're seeing this rather than the political leadership try to calm people down, instead they're stoking those fears and they're calling on people to carry guns, and the mayor of Jerusalem is carrying a gun everywhere he goes, and it seems like the reaction that Israelis are taking the advice of Ben Carson instead of actually looking at what's a real solution to end this conflict. So the U.S. is the only country that really has the leverage, that has the relationship with Israel, that can you know, press Israel to move toward a wake-up call and for a different direction on and different kind of national discourse. So it's that's why you know, people taking the time to call members of Congress and urge the administration to take a bold step here is so important. And as you said, I mean, there are a lot of crises in the Middle East right now. But as you said, I mean, the fate of the these holy sites of the Haram al-Sharif, I mean, that already it has sent reverberations throughout the Muslim world. So the threat that Palestinians could be barred from there. What Palestinians do not want to see is, and they're afraid that they will see, is the Haram al-Sharif compound, that it will be like the Ibrahimi Mosque situation in Hebron, where we see that area has just been often, closed off to Palestinians, and then there are concerns that they'll that Haram al-Sharif will be closed off entirely to Palestinians. So we, as you say, I mean that and any kind of threats toward the compound would be absolutely catastrophic. So this is an urgent issue and a time when the U.S. can really make a difference.
So given that the Palestinian leadership have just basically seemed to have thrown up their hands and have given up dealing with the Israelis, and they've said that they no longer want to abide by the Oslo Agreement, and Prime Minister Netanyahu doesn't seem to have a solution, and the people to his right, I think he seems more concerned about them than anything else. And if he falls, it's unlikely that there'd be anybody less amenable, in fact, more hardline, one would think. And then you've got the security people who seem to be the really sensible people in Israel, who understand that Israel's military force is extraordinary. And it's a huge military force, and it's able to maintain the security of Israel in a very dangerous neighborhood. But if you have an intifada, if you have the Palestinians on your doorstep erupting, that's Israel's Achilles heel. And you will never have peace in that part of the world. They're the first people the Israelis should make a deal with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's so obvious.
That's
right. And that seems to be what the security people have always understood. That, you know, we only have tactics, but we don't have a strategy when it comes to solving the Palestinian problem. And the Palestinians seem to be the people, you know, if you push them too far, they could really cause Israel some real trouble. The rest of the neighborhood, as bad as it is, I don't think can lay a glove on the Israelis.
Yeah, what we're seeing here is that, you know, there are these ordinary Palestinians, these children and women and teenagers who've been committing acts of violence on the Palestinian side, and of course on the Israeli side, also some self-described non-political Israelis or that are not directly connected to the Israeli state, who've been committing these acts of violence. And of course, and all violence is wrong. But you know, you said if you push the Palestinians too far, one lesson here that we've seen repeated all over the world is if you push any group too far, so that they feel cornered and they feel like they don't have any kind of future, then it's not about a certain getting a certain political leadership or whatever or those kinds of short term outcomes. It's really about addressing the big picture, so that you have these kids who have no political affiliation, but they also know that they have no future. They have no future growing up in East Jerusalem, where they don't have citizenship. I mean, they have, they've been living under occupation, and of course, that nothing justifies these acts of violence. And at the same time, we have to realize that so long as this occupation continues, so long as these collective punishment measures continue, then this violence will continue. And it won't just be from certain political and violent extremist organizations. It won't just. It will actually come from random individuals who have nothing to lose. And that's the most dangerous thing for the whole world, and whether it's in Syria or in the West Bank or anywhere else. And so that's why we at least, this is a human-made conflict, and it is grim, but there are even some short-term steps that can be implemented right now that can calm the situation, that certainly ensuring that the status quo, that Muslims are allowed to worship at Al-Aqsa Mosque, that's going to be absolutely critical, and hearing that from these leaders. And while Netanyahu is never going to do this on his own, and while other Palestinian, other leaders are not going to do it, the U.S. can be influential here and can make a difference and can save lives.
Just in the last minute, President Obama presumably doesn't have to worry about being reelected. Can he take a strong stand?
Of course. This would be an important legacy for him to show that he's not going to let this conflict fester even further for the next president, that he can take a courageous stand in calling for an end to incitement, an end to killings on all sides, and ensuring the religious freedom and protection of that at this holy site in Jerusalem, and ensuring that the U.S. actually uses its leverage to save lives rather than use it to perpetuate the system that is taking lives.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Kate Gould.
Thank you so much, Ian. Really appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Kate Gould, who's a Legislative Associate for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies for Israel-Palestine peace. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining last night's first Democratic presidential debate and whether Bernie Sanders could break the tradition of presidents ultimately serving America's elites. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair for Political Science at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. He is the author of Class War, Economic Inequality, and the American Dream, and Who Governs? Presidents, Public Opinion, and Manipulation. His forthcoming book is Fed Power, How Finance Wins and Democratic Accountability is Restored. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be back with you.
And your latest book, Who Governs? Presidents, Public Opinion, and Manipulation, makes the case, essentially, that the presidents, whether they're Democrat or Republican, are guided by the elites, and they tend to use public or tend to shape public opinion to disguise the fact that they're really favoring and, in fact, doing what the elites effectively tell them what to do, or servicing the elites, if you will. Given the presence of Bernie Sanders there on the stage last night on the Democratic debate, is he an exception to that rule? Not that he's president, and most people don't give him, they don't exactly suggest that he's a shoo-in, but is he something of a change from your thesis?
Yes, if he were to get elected, it would be a dramatic change. And you could hear Bernie Sanders last night making the case that you would need millions of people to turn out to change the political equation and to really rewrite the social contract in America.
Well, your book is buttressed by last Sunday's New York Times front page story that 158 families in the United States have donated nearly half of the money going into the 2016 candidates, and the donors are overwhelmingly white men, many in the finance and energy industries. So there you have it.
Yeah, I mean, what was most striking for us is we are going into the black box, the kind of hidden sanctum of the White House. We're getting access to the confidential, secret memos and reports that are reaching the desk of presidents. And the case of Ronald Reagan is the most striking because he's using polls not to track what the majority of Americans think in order to cater to that, but rather to track the views of the affluent and the conservative parts of his coalition. That was his focus. The question for him was, how does he use his personality and the presentation of policy to try to woo the rest of the country? This answers the question I think has been on a lot of people's minds. How could you have a country in which inequality is large and growing within a system of democratic elections?
So, in effect, Reagan, of course, he had a famous kitchen cabinet of millionaires and billionaires that advised him. How would you relate his tenure to Obama's? Because many people felt that with all of the hope for change and the promises, et cetera, at the end of the day, because Wall Street was the biggest donor to Obama, that somehow he caved. He certainly had the Wall Street over a barrel when he came in because they had almost destroyed the global economy. And it doesn't seem like he got much out of Wall Street in exchange for bailing them out.
You know, I would tell you as a researcher that we need to get into the records and see what happened, but my expectation and hunch is that we will discover quite a bit of back and forth between Wall Street and the big financiers, and particularly the Treasury Department, where you had some pretty strong ties back to Wall Street. And there were just a number of different issues, including efforts to rescue homeowners that were pursued in Britain and other countries that were blocked by the Treasury in America. Those would be the points where I'd expect to see the heavy hand of finance pushing the Obama administration.
So in terms of the debate last night, it's obviously a stark contrast to the Republican debates. It was almost entirely about substance and positions on policies and issues, and there was no, you know, sniping and character assassination and the kind of pettiness that we saw on the Republican side. But, of course, the Republican debate actually got more viewers, both of them did, although this debate last night attracted a record 15.3 million viewers to CNN. What was your takeaway on it?
You know, having viewers is one measure of how a debate goes, but, you know, we have to remember this is going to be a long, 14-month process. And one of the real concerns among Republican insiders and strategists is that all those viewers of Republican debates could be a problem, particularly women and people of color and the rising number of Latino and Hispanic voters, because those people are walking away from Republican debates with their hair on end. These debates, particularly the comments of Donald Trump and then the silence by the other candidates, has been devastating for the Republican name brand and could well become a liability. So I think the large numbers turning out to watch the Republican debates and the lack of content, the focus on personality and sometimes savage comments about folks in America could well backfire on Republicans.
But the extent to which the takeaway lines were Hillary Clinton's line that I'm a progressive, but a progressive who likes to get things done. Bernie Sanders' line, I suppose, was Congress doesn't regulate Wall Street. Wall Street regulates Congress. The line that got the most applause was when actually Bernie Sanders came to Hillary's rescue over this phony scandal over emails by saying, enough already with the emails, you know. That was an indirect slap at the press. How do you navigate through the press, particularly the Democrats, since they were so much more about substance, when no matter how crazy the remarks are that Trump or Carson make, they get headlines? And when Bernie or Hillary says something substantive about policy prescriptions, they're all but ignored.
Well, I think it's definitely a challenge. It's one of the reasons why social media and podcasts and alternative media are so important. But again, I think headlines on Donald Trump is bad news for the Republicans. And the smart Republican strategists know that. Having Donald Trump dominate the headlines, particularly when he's making comments about immigrants and undocumented folks in America as rapists, you know, this is terrible news for Republicans. That's not good news. You know, I think there were a number of messages that did break through last night, particularly comments that Hillary Clinton made about women, the comments that were made by all the candidates about doing more for the struggling middle class and working people. Those comments did break through, and that is a very stark contrast. The other part is we will soon be into the general election. The question is it 6 months or 8 months? And we're setting up for a contest that may be the sharpest contrast between the most conservative, maybe right-wing candidate we've seen in America in a very long time, and a progressive alternative.
Are you suggesting that the Republican candidate will be Donald Trump?
If it's not Donald Trump, it'll be someone who's kind of Donald Trump light. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jeb Bush seems to be really struggling, and the candidate that's receiving more attention, whether it's Carly Fiorina or Senator Rubio, these are very conservative people who, to win the nomination of the Republican Party, have probably moved so far to the right that they're going to be easily targeted by the Democratic nominee. Whereas if you look last night, Hillary Clinton moved a bit to the left, but she was very cautious and left herself plenty of outs to run a campaign in the general election that will have more of a chance to appeal to middle America. That is a huge difference, just looking down the road and kind of projecting what the general election is going to look like.
Well, actually, I mentioned Bernie Sanders coming to Hillary's rescue on the emails and saying enough already, and this is a failure of the press to deal with real issues. Interestingly enough, both CNN and MSNBC edited out Bernie Sanders' criticism of the media's election coverage in their post-debate coverage. So there you have a problem, don't you? We have a broken political system that's money-driven. Our politicians have been turned into telemarketers. They spend most of their day on the phone asking for money. Then when they raise that money, they turn that money over largely to the media monopolies to buy TV times to get themselves reelected. So what do you make of the press's defensiveness in the face of Bernie Sanders' criticism?
It's you know, it's obviously a huge problem. There's a kind of a cycle here. But rather than being a virtuous cycle, it's the opposite, as you're suggesting. And clearly the magnitude of money, but how the money's being raised and from whom, is locking in an advantage for the, not just the affluent, but for the super rich, that may be, you know, without precedent in the last 40 to 50 years. You know, we're kind of going back to a century ago. And you're right, the media, you know, if you've got money, you've just got a tremendous advantage in terms of reaching out to the press. But, you know, there's not just one media out there. And I think that's what's changed. There's just a lot of opportunities and alternative sources of information. And we're seeing that. People are pretty astute as to where they can get good news.
Well, but in terms of the difference between Hillary and Bernie, where Bernie, of course, talked about needing revolutionary change, and that will require the people to get involved in a movement, whereas Hillary Clinton is obviously much less revolutionary and more or less saying that, you know, I can make the change through the presidency. So Sanders is talking about a movement. Clinton is talking about becoming president and making change from that point of view. To that extent, it seems to be something of a rerun of the 2018 Clinton-Obama contest with Bernie Sanders in Obama's role.
I think Bernie Sanders is, you know, qualitatively more radical in his politics than Barack Obama was in 2007. You know, they're just very different candidates with different profiles. I did think it was, you know, quite telling the number of instances in which Bernie Sanders was attaching himself to President Obama. If you look at Bernie Sanders' record of voting, he's been one of the Democrats who's challenged the president on a number of issues. So, but, you know, again, what was really striking, as you said about last night, is how substantive the debate was, how many times, you know, the candidates would, for the most part, rally around the same message and draw the contrast with the Republicans. This, despite the press coverage of the first opening sections, this was not an acrimonious debate. This was really almost an advertisement for the Democratic perspective as opposed to the Republican proposals.
So, to my mind, Lawrence Jacobs, I sensed a sort of a perfect duo, if you will, on the stage last night, and that is Hillary Clinton, who came across as being extremely well-informed, very quick, very nimble, and very, very sharp and very knowledgeable. And I'm sure she made, certainly she, everybody, the punditry is already saying that it basically knocks Biden out of the box. It more or less closes the door on any speculation of him entering the race. But more than that, it seemed to me that, you know, there's a certain comfort factor, and this is a pro. But if she was teamed up with Bernie Sanders as the vice president, wouldn't that be a kind of a perfect duo for the Democrats, that Hillary reassures everybody that she's a professional, and those that feel that she's a little too centrist and a little too pro-Wall Street and whatever the bill against her is, Bernie, on the other hand, is the heart and soul of the progressive movement. And more importantly, as he pointed out on a number of occasions in the debate last night, he's the guy that's going to get people out to the polls.
You know, that makes a lot of sense, and I could see that appealing to Democrats, but I don't think that's the way Hillary Clinton will see it if she becomes a nominee. We've realized in the last 20 years that the vice presidential candidate doesn't really have much of an impact on the election because so much of the attention is focused on the party's standard bearer. And so the VP candidate has become kind of the behind-the-scenes governing kind of partner. So, you know, Joe Biden didn't win any votes or states for Barack Obama, but what he did do is he brought experience and was trusted by Barack Obama to help him govern and take on some of the big issues. You could say the same thing about, you know, Walter Mondale to Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was someone who really relied on President, on Vice President Mondale in governing. So that's the direction I think Hillary Clinton would move, was to find someone she was comfortable with in terms of governing, rather than thinking of the VP's position as a kind of balancing of her more centrist views.
Well, of course, the exception to that rule was Dick Cheney, right?
it was, but, you know, I think it's probably the case that Dick Cheney disappointed the Bush advisors. They did not expect him to be the radical that he ended up being, and there's been speculation that, you know, one of his heart attacks may have kind of had an effect on his judgment. I mean, that's speculation by Republicans like Brent Scowcroft.
Right, but there's also a lot of speculation, or more than speculation, pretty strong evidence that in many ways Cheney usurped Bush's presidency right out from under him. And
There's no doubt, in my mind, what I've seen, there's no doubt about that. Yeah. Though I would say in the second term, you see President Bush pulling back a lot of that power, and by the end, Cheney has been locked out of the key decisions and was quite bitter about the way he was treated.
Right. Well, apparently the key moment was that just before the 2004 election between Kerry and Bush was that famous scene at Ashcroft's bedside where Bush was found out exactly the extent to which Cheney had done an end run around Comey, and Comey finally told Bush the truth, and Bush realized that the whole Justice Department was about to resign a few weeks before the elections. You know, So the politician finally recognized the damage that his vice president
had. But I think the key thing here is that for Hillary Clinton, there was probably no one on the stage last night who would be on the short list for a VP candidate. You know, I would be looking more for, you know, maybe a moderate Latino, you know, or maybe a sitting governor that she's comfortable with, who kind of shares her worldview.
Right.
This has been a big change in the last, I'd say, 3 to 4 elections, away from the kind of balancing view.
Right. Well, she does that at her own peril, I guess.
Well, I mean, the question that you'd need to ask and ponder would be, how many people who would have normally voted for her if she had had Sanders on her ticket will now turn around and not vote and hold the prospect of, you know, possibly electing the most conservative Republican ticket, you know, in at least half a century.
Sure, and but of course that's always been the Democrats' argument.
At
the end
of the
day,
strategy.
They always say, look, it's, you know, it's us or the sky will fall and the Supreme Court
will... Well, it could be that case this time.
Yeah, oh, definitely. I don't think you need to qualify that. Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Yes, good to be with you. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Science at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. He is the author of Class War, Economic Inequality and the American Dream, and Who Governs? Presidents, Public Opinion, and Manipulation. And his forthcoming book is Fed Power, How Finance Wins and Democratic Accountability is Restored. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with Dr. Anna Greenberg, a leading pollster who thinks that Bernie Sanders will fade away like Howard Dean did.
The peddlers and the meddlers, they buy and they sell. They destroyed your city, they'll destroy you as well. The lecherous and treacherous, a hair meant for leather, each of them bigger. Together, sluggers and muggers, wearing fancy gold.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Anna Greenberg, who's a leading Democratic pollster with Greenberg Quinlan Rosner. She's an expert in survey research methodology and has taught at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government and was a visiting scholar with the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, and is a research fellow at the American University Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Anna Greenberg.
Thank you.
And last night's first Democratic debate clearly contrasted with the two previous presidential debates by the Republicans. It didn't get quite the ratings that the Republicans got, but it got a substantial rating for CNN, I think 15.8 million Americans. So are we in a universe where substance and policy prescriptions and serious debate trumps personality, insult, headline grabbing, the kind of stuff that we've been getting from Donald Trump and Ben Carson and Carly Fiorina. What's your sense of where the American people stand?
Well, I think it depends on which audience you're talking about. I think, sorry to cast aspersions on the media, of which you are part of. If you think about the media, I think Trump, insults, you know, hair, looks, continues to be great fodder. I mean, this is about making money. So, you know, a lot of what has happened on the Republican side is truly a creation of the media coverage that Donald Trump in particular, but others like Carly Fiorina and Ben Carson have received. I think somebody said that the amount of free media or earned media, as we call it in the campaign world, that Donald Trump has received is the equivalent of about $50 million of the television. So you know, some of this is kind of, and part of the reason why I think, frankly, the Democrats don't get as much attention is that they don't have kind of the interesting, flamboyant celebrity insult sort of culture in the Democratic primary. And so it's not as newsworthy in that sense. Now, if you talk about the voters, that's a different story. I think ultimately you're going to find that if we continue to have Democratic debates that are civil, that are substantive, where people are making coherent arguments about where they want to see the country go and they look presidential and dignified, I think that is going to be, for the voters, a really important contrast between the two fields. It's too early to know. We've only, you know, the debate was last night, so it'll be about a week, I think, before we can really see in the polling if, you know, Hillary Clinton starts breaking away again. I suspect she will be breaking away, certainly from Trump and others, but we don't really know yet. So I think there's kind of two different audiences for this. The media wants the insults and the sort of crazy talk on a range of issues as long as possible because it's great for ratings and they make a lot of money. I think when it comes to the electorate, it's very early days for them, and I think the kind of, like I said, I think the substantive and serious and you know, respectful nature of the Democratic primary debate will be a very helpful contrast when we get to the general election.
Well, when Bernie Sanders sort of came to Hillary Clinton's rescue last night, where she was being questioned yet again about the emails and the Benghazi manufactured scandals, Bernie Sanders came to her rescue and said, "Enough already with the I'm sick of the to death of this email stuff." And it was a very clear criticism of the press. What I found interesting was that both MSNBC and CNN cut out that exchange, or at least that part of it, in their post-debate coverage. So how do you deal with the press in terms of getting substance past sensation, in the sense that, you know, our politicians today have been turned into telemarketers where they spend all their day just about asking for money, and then that money is then turned over to the mainstream media monopolies in the form of television advertising to get themselves elected or re-elected. So the media seems to be a part of our broken system, if you are to accept what Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton are saying about this rigged and unfair political system we have in the United States.
Well, I mean, I would agree with your assessment, and I don't necessarily have a good answer. I mean, throughout the whole period of the coverage of Benghazi morphing into emails, and of course Hillary Clinton is going to testify, I believe, next week in Congress in front of the Benghazi committee, that Hillary Clinton has been releasing, you know, very substantive, very populist policy proposals ranging from everything from executive compensation to the trade agreement. And, you know, you would think the only thing that she is talking about is email. So it has been very difficult for Hillary Clinton for any of the substantive things she's doing to break through, and I don't necessarily have a great answer. And I think it will continue because of this hearing, and frankly, it may continue because of the upheaval in Republican leadership in the House. And if one of the Tea Party folks becomes the Speaker of the House, we may expect more investigating committees on top of the ones that we already have, that they might try to sort of embroil her into. So I don't see it ending anytime soon.
So the extent to which Bernie Sanders said this is not a necessarily politically popular thing to do, but came to his rival's rescue, if you will, it struck me at that moment that this is not a bad duo in terms of, it was very clear that Hillary Clinton is extremely competent, very quick, very nimble, very well informed. I think people in this country can be reassured by her professionalism as President of the United States. Her knowledge and experience is manifest. And on the other hand, Bernie Sanders is bringing out thousands and thousands of young people who the Democrats need to vote, because it's clearly always about turnout when it comes to the Democrats. We learned that from the last midterm election where they got trounced because they didn't have the turnout. So does this make sense that she's the president and he's the vice president?
Well, there's a few things. You know, one, people forget that Hillary Clinton was immensely popular when she left her position as Secretary of State, and she's sort of been beaten down. Some of it's been self-inflicted, no question, and some of it's been sort of Republicans and media. But I think people were reminded last night, oh, she's really smart. and she knows what she's doing, and she's competent. I mean, I think that a lot of the things that people liked about her as Secretary of State, where, again, she was immensely popular, people were reminded of that. They were reminded that she is sort of presidential. I think the problem with Sanders is twofold. One, it's fine to bring people out for rallies. Organizing on the ground to actually get out voters in caucuses and primaries, but especially caucuses, is really hard. And you just have to think about Howard Dean in 2004, who was a bit of a Bernie Sanders, a truth teller, authentic, a yeller, if you will, and people excited about it. And he couldn't get people out into the Iowa caucuses. So he has there's a real mismatch in terms of organization on the ground. In this sense, campaigns matter, and he needs that kind of campaign to rack up some victories. And if he doesn't rack up a bunch of victories, there's no reason to put him on the ticket. He's from Vermont, and he's not even a Democrat. So there's no question in my mind that if Hillary Clinton's the nominee, we will have probably someone who's Hispanic on the ticket with her as the VP candidate. I just don't. Bernie Sanders doesn't really bring her anything when it comes to a kind of general electorate. He's exciting young people, but they are liberal Democrats who he's exciting, right? It's very different when you get to a general election.
Do you accept the possibility, though, Dr. Greenberg, that there is a new kind of zeitgeist out there in the political world? This is the era or the year or of the outsider, that there's an inside game and an outside game, as some of the pundits were saying last night in the spin room, the extent to which Trump and Carson, these outsiders, are doing so well on the Republican side. And the theory is that Bernie Sanders is also doing well because there's a general frustration with politics as usual. So if that's the dynamic out there, what's to suggest that that's going to go away?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there is a desire for people who speak truth to power. I hate to use the word authenticity because it keeps getting used over and over again on the cable news. And that can come from somebody who's an insider or an outsider. So if you look at Mayor Bill de Blasio in New York City or Senator Elizabeth Warren, you know, they both won those elections in part because they were sort of speaking truth to power. They were telling the truth about the system being rigged. And I think you probably see the same thing on the right in these Republican primaries where you get the sort of the far right Tea Party Republicans beating establishment Republicans because they're telling a truth, a quote-unquote truth, to those voters. So I think that, you know, what's as important about Trump is not just that he's not a politician, it's that people perceive him to be authentic, and he's not. I mean, he's a chameleon, but regardless, that's what they see. So I think it's less about not being a politician and more about being somebody who kind of speaks the truth as they see it to a certain bunch of people who believe that truth. And that's why Bernie Sanders is popular, and he is a very long-time politician. He was a mayor, a member of Congress, and now a senator. He's been in elective office most of his life, but people see him as somebody who's speaking the truth. Now, when we get to the general election, the truth of the matter is partisanship trumps everything. When you have your D and your R, you have your Democratic candidate and your Republican candidate, voting decisions are driven by partisanship. There's a very narrow slice of the electorate that truly is sort of independent and doesn't have a preference, and they are influenced by campaign communication, but it's a very small number of people. And at that point, this whole question of insider-outsider kind of gets trumped by people's partisan predispositions, and it makes elections less interesting to know that most of it's already decided. And certainly, as someone who is a consultant to campaigns, you don't have a lot of operating room to sort of persuade, because there aren't that many people who are persuadable when you get into a general election context at the federal level.
But what about the turnout factor, the inspiration factor? Isn't that something that, you know, the Republicans seem to be able to get all of their people out, and they get them fired up and get them angry and get them confused, but they get them out. The Democrats quite often have problems inspiring their people, and if Bernie is not going to be around in the general, is the assumption then on the part of the Democrats that well, you know, people are going to just rally behind Hillary because the other side is so much worse, which has always been basically the Democrats' argument?
Well, I would, you know, ask that you watch that debate again. She was pretty inspiring. She was smart and tough and articulate, and she looked good, which is not an insignificant thing. She looked young and vibrant. You're assuming that Hillary Clinton can't be a general election candidate. That's inspiring, and I don't think that's true. I don't know either way. I don't work on the campaign, but I think that there is a Hillary Clinton that's inspiring.
Sure.
I think that's I don't think you can assume in October of 2015 that Hillary Clinton won't inspire people to come out to vote.
Well, I'm not suggesting that Hillary's not inspiring. I'm saying that what happens to Bernie's people, the people that he's inspired, surely you want them to vote for Hillary, right?
And they will, because they're never going to vote for a Republican. And it's not very many people. We're talking about Democratic primary voters, which is a very small slice of the electorate. But let me tell you, there were plenty of Hillary Clinton voters who voted for Barack Obama. At the end of the day, the ideologically committed activists, which is a big part of the sort of Bernie Sanders base, will not sit out an election, particularly if they think a Republican might win. Everyone worried that Hillary Clinton voters wouldn't support Barack Obama, and the vast majority of them did. No question there were some white, blue-collar, rural Democrats in places like West Virginia and Kentucky and those sorts of places who ultimately voted against Obama. That was driven by race, and those were not in states that were in play in the Electoral College. So I am not worried at all that somehow the Bernie Sanders voters don't come out and or vote against Hillary Clinton. They'll be there. These are real voters.
Right, but my understanding is that since Sanders is ahead in the polls in New Hampshire and is climbing in the polls in Iowa, what happens, and again we go back to the press, you know how it is, suddenly Bernie Sanders wins New Hampshire, and then he becomes, the toast of the town and the headline, and then if he wins Iowa, then it's a whole different dynamic. Whether or not he peters out in the end, it seems to me that it's certainly too early to write him off.
I feel very comfortable writing him off. First of all, you have to have a campaign. You have to have organizers on the ground. Ask Howard Dean how hard it is to get caucus goers in Iowa out for you. That organizational process happens over months and months and months, where precinct captain endorsements matter, where elected officials' endorsements matter. Hillary Clinton has racked up most of the Iowa endorsements. So campaigns matter. Nevada, is a caucus state. She's hugely popular among Hispanics. It's a big chunk of the Democratic primary electorate in Nevada. Campaigns really matter in primaries. And she has an operation that knows what it's doing, and it's built, and it's big. And so it's immaterial to me that right now Bernie Sanders is leading in New Hampshire, because, next year what matters is, does he have an effective campaign on the ground? The other thing I would add, by the way, is that primary voters are strategic voters. There's no cost right now to say, I'm for Bernie Sanders. On election day, if you think you're going to vote for someone who's going to lose, you may change your vote. So I think polls right now are meaningless. It's all about organization, and it's all about strategic voting.
So when Bernie Sanders talks about the need for millions to come out in a revolution, he knows then that that's what he needs. That he doesn't have the ground game, right?
I don't know what he knows. He's not running a conventional campaign, which is fine.
Right.
I don't really think he does much polling. Right. I think he is who he is, and he's doing what he wants. And I think that has conveys, a real authenticity. I believe it's genuine. But again, go back to Howard Dean. Those kinds of candidates are not necessarily good at actually putting together a campaign that can pull people out to vote on election day.
Well, Anna Greenberg, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Anna Greenberg, who's a leading Democratic pollster with Greenberg Quinlan Rosner. She's an expert in survey research methodology, and she's taught at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government and was a visiting scholar with the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, and is a research fellow at American University Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.